97, 13, 12, State of Ohio, Jesse James Collins, for check.
Counsel, but not counsel of your choice. You had the county public defender, and then he didn't like them, so he asked that other counsel be appointed, and the court agreed to that, didn't it?
Well, I'd like to address that in two steps, if I may, Your Honor.
Sure.
First of all, I don't believe that counsel was appointed to defend because the judge didn't like them. The first counsel was appointed because they had spoken to him regarding a plea bargain 3.5 weeks prior to arraignment, when, in fact, the docket will show that at that point, discovery had not even been filed. As a matter of fact, the day before the arraignment, counsel filed a motion to compel discovery. So at that point, they had not reviewed discovery, and they were already talking to Jesse about pleading guilty.
Well, but with the facts of this case, with him murdering this 67 or 69-year-old lady and leaving her tied to a refrigerator and all, by that time, counsel would have known what the facts were, wouldn't they?
They may have known what the facts were as a resident in the indictment, Your Honor, but they didn't have any of the blood tests that were. There was blood found on the body. They didn't have those blood tests. They didn't have fingerprints on. They had any alibi witnesses that became an alibi. So there was a lot of information that was not available to them at that point, especially if they not yet received discovery.
Can you talk to the public defender about that? I mean, you're telling me that the public defender was telling him to enter into a plea bargain when the public defender didn't even know the facts of the case or the evidence.
I'm sure I believe it's what the record as a public counsel, and to my research on the subject indicated that counsel did acknowledge that he had spoken to Jesse about a plea bargain 3.5 weeks prior to the arraignment, and the docket also indicates that, first of all, the notice of intent to use evidence in a bill particular were not filed until the end of October, which would have been after that conversation, and a motion to compel the government was filed day before arraignment. So we can only assume from those facts that the council did not have any of that information with them when it was talking to just about a plea bargain.
But isn't it complicated?
Standpoint, the trial court has to use a balancing test, Ms. Burkett, but this court then uses what sort of test? I presume that our test is looking more toward how that relationship played out. I mean, once the court denied it, our test would be how did that play out? Was counsel able to function as counsel for this particular capital defendant? So do you plan to address that? Was it shown, even though it was denied, now we have to look at the error. Was there prejudicial error?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the record would indicate that the relationship never improved. In fact, the defendant's own sentencing memorandum, he wrote three full pages suggesting behavior during the trial, including anger directed at his attorney, after he produced
That conduct strikes me as more akin to the sort of conduct we see about the it's the defendant and whether the defendant could have participated. Sounds like that might be a separate issue. But he was angry with his counsel. I mean, did counsel put forth a proper defense? Did counsel confer with him? It seemed that there were some things in the record that showed that he indeed was consulting with counsel and was accepting advice from them.
I think there's indications in the record that counsel was talking to the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything that ever says that Jeff became comfortable with his counsel. In fact, prior to trial, his counsel
I mean, in the best of all worlds, we want the defendant to be comfortable with counsel and to trust counsel, but we have to look at whether he was denied his constitutional right to be represented. And so comfort might not be the test. What would be the test?
The test would be whether or not the defendant is able to communicate with counsel and whether or not the defendant trusts counsel. Those are the standards that we'll talk about. They all discussed whether or not there was an open channel of communication. And in fact, in one instance, the attorney said, I want to communicate, but he's not communicating with me. And the court found that that was sufficient to open a new attorney to the appointment. In this case, we also asked that, I mean, the court needs to consider the fact that this was not, that this request was made a month prior to the trial. It was not the instance where the person was asking mid-trial replacement or immediately pre-trial replacement. And the fact that the defense attorney themselves concurred in the defendant's belief that he's not communicating with them is a very important aspect for the court to consider. So I presume that with the fact on this record, the court court should have appointed the counsel. There's, of course, no way of knowing what the outcome would have been either at the trial or at the sentencing level if just he had been sexually communicating with the counsel.
Can we tell from the record how much of the ineffective communication is based upon the result of the defendant not liking the advice that he got from his counsel?
There's no indication, Your Honor, and I think the reason is that both the attorney and defendant himself felt it. Delving into the reasons for the lack of communication would be a violation of attorney-client privilege. At one point during the February 19th hearing, the trial court is attempting to press the death penalty reason. He says, I know that you tell me anything I say here won't be used against me, but the prosecutor is sitting right there. So it's clear that he doesn't feel comfortable going into detail about the problems with his attorney with the prosecutor there. He's never given the chance otherwise. There's no other way to move on.
I guess the reason for the question is really to follow up the justice question. He really did follow the advice of counsel a number of times. This is the viewing scene. He said he waived his right to view the scene based upon the advice of my counsel. He didn't appear at several other times, and it was after he talked to counsel. Counsel said that he discussed the autopsy report with him in detail, and he understood it. And I guess that's why, you know, we have a defendant who obviously is not going to like all the advice an honest counsel would give him, I suggest, in a case such as this. I'm trying to determine if there's any indication of that here, but on the record of the there's not.
There's not, and I would also point out that the indication of the time when he was communicating with counsel to that extent, they're not on the substantive matter of the case. Not going to see the jury people will certainly be in keeping with Judge in general that he was not participating in that trial with counsel.
Well, that's my point, that he picks and chooses when he wants to disagree with counsel and on substantive issues, perhaps he doesn't like the advice of counsel. I mean, this is the evidence here is pretty strong against him, isn't it? The forensic evidence certainly have fingerprints, they have a trail, they have, you know, a confession. And, I mean, so he wouldn't like some of the advice, I would guess, that a very candid, honest, in the broadest sense of the term, counsel might give him. And so he says, I don't want you. You're not telling me what I want to hear. But he obviously followed his advice when on some procedural matters where perhaps it's easier to take the advice. I don't know how we write. I'm not sure where I'm going with the rule on this, but it seems to me that has to be an element in some of these cases, at least, where a death penalty defendant is not happy with the information getting from counsel.
I feel that it's important to stress that it's not just unhappiness about the information he was getting from counsel. Counsel himself stated that after significant new evidence has been revealed to them, that being the alleged confession of Jesse to a jailhouse net, that they were never able to communicate regarding that information. They couldn't interview him regarding what the jailhouse had said. So, and at the February 28th hearing here, the counsel denied the motion that was made on Jesse's behalf by the attorney, so the motion they asked that they made was for himself, but the motion they made on his behalf. So it does make it very clear that Jesse has two choices. He can stay in this trial with the two counsel with whom he's not communicating, or he can represent himself.
Or he could communicate with them. You know,
that's where you arrive at the level of trust between the attorney and the defendant.
What's our standard of review then, Ms. Burkett? Is this an abuse of discretion? Do you looking to us find that the court abused its discretion? And the primary, I take it the primary, the strongest case you have is that I'm wondering what your test is, if it's an abuse of discretion standard, and what is the test? You know, we've agreed it's not whether or not the defendant's comfortable, and it's not, is it, the cases suggest this must be a complete breakdown of communication. Do you agree with that test from McGee and...
Right.
But what test do you ask us to
I would ask that you determine whether or not the judge used the proper balance. The two main factors.
That was, and that's abuse of discretion.
That's abuse of discretion. The two main factors the court below seem to look at is whether or not Jesse's actions were civil purposes or whether or not they were bad faith. And it would be our position that there's no evidence of either in this case. This case from indictment to death is 7 months, which is an incredibly short period of time for most cases of this nature, which the court surely knows. The period of time from first indictment to the request for sending counsel is 5 months. It's a very short period of time. And also, the trial court wants to look at the fact that this was the second set of counsel that he asked for, but we have to also not consider that this, I don't like the first counsel. There is a legitimate reason on the record for him being unhappy with them trying to pressure him into a plea bargain before the specimen is ever filed.
So we're only really, that's a factor in there that counsel was substituted once, but we're looking at the refusal to substitute the second trial counsel, in fact.
Right. And if you were to look at the facts of whether or not this is still a claim, whether or not there was trade on the case, whether or not defense counsel themselves agreed with it, all of those to mitigate in favor of having this man dead in the capital to finally ask for it. I think it's also important to look at the nature of the offense. I mean, when I'm talking about a misdemeanor theft, we're not even talking about a felony theft here. We're talking about the most serious charges that a person could have in our country and in the world.
But if the defendant, trial courts are looking at the defendant and hearing his complaints, and if it's things like they want to keep talking to me about that palm print, which is reality, there is this palm print, and the defendant, at what point do you factor in that a capital defendant who's surely up against it, and maybe even not the easiest person to get along with. How do we factor that in at this level? I mean, we know trial courts are looking and hearing and assessing.
What I would ask the court to do at this level is to review the factors that the judge considered at the time. And it is our agreement that the judge simply did not look beyond the fact that he had appointed counsel at the time and he was not going to talk to counsel again. There was no doubt in the test at all. He didn't play any of the factors that...
One's enough. He just said one substitution's enough.
Exactly. And our position, you can't draw a lack of letter of law test for this particular rule. You've got to be able to measure.
He seemed to be unaware of what the will of the concept was between the client and the lawyer. Is that in the record or the
It is not
if you're saying the reason that this is in the record is that the judge simply said, I see this is the second complaint concerning the procedural concerns. Is that what you're saying to us?
I don't know that that's the reason it's not in the record. I shouldn't say that this is not more than required further with the Deputy Dean would have ever been able to articulate the reason other than I don't trust my attorney to stay asking why.
And were these the same reasons he gave for the first lawyer?
There was additional information given on the second attorney, and that was that they had asked him why, so he did not say why. And if he didn't want to trust the attorney,
I'm getting at is that there has to be a line drawn, first of all,
all of these factors into consideration, then the bar president, at this particular time, when he was denied counsel for that time. None of the things that important was from lower court in terms of the village lawyer that day. The second issue that I would like to address is that number 8, in which you say that the court was under a duty to inquire into the competency of Jesse Swain to the agent, especially based on the activity that she, on the actions she had during the trial and pre-trial and post-trial phase. The defense attorney referred to the agent in Vardir, so there was an indication that they did plan to possess Vardir. It's our position that at this time, that sensing that the issue took place, the attorney client communication, again, was continually raised down to that point forward. At that point, Jesse would have no more part of the trial. As I indicated earlier, the judge devoted 3 pages of discussing opinion to Judge Jackson, beginning pre-trial when he left the courtroom, refusing to have to answer questions. And again, the deputy was having to hold him down and removing the TV from the total chamber. All of this was indicative to the judge that there could very possibly have to be something going on, and in our position, it was in a position where he should have inquired into that further and did not. And as such, there's nothing on the record that indicates that Jesse was prompted to make a mitigation at that point. We understand that this court has ruled that under Section 8, that would be a tactical.
I'm sorry, excuse me, but if a defendant is competent to stand trial, wouldn't the decision to waive mitigation or refuse, in this case, are we going to separate those? There's no assertion that he wasn't competent to stand trial. At least there's no proposition of law on that subject, right? So the idea that someone would be competent to stand trial, but their decision to waive mitigation could be incompetent. I'm thinking it's the same individual at the same period of time.
Well, Your Honor, at the time of the mediation here, the judge had a series of actions and agreements that were not present before that time.
Well,
the entire chain of events that led up to that.
Okay. But you're suggesting that he became incompetent at that point, that there were more indications for the court to inquire.
There certainly would be a question as to whether or not he was competent at the time of the trial, but the fact that he actually waived mitigation brings that issue before the court. He's under 60 years, and it brings the issue to the forefront for the court to make a determination. And it was actually in the sentencing memorandum that this judge chose to list out these factors and list out these indicators to discuss it.
This is pre-arraignment. What in how many days or months are we talking about that they did all this work?
I'm not sure the time frame they did.
From arrest to arraignment would be?
Maybe 4 months.
Months.
And the most evidence against him has been developed and early on, and they would have been available to counsel or and so they would have been able to know about the ammunition that they had against him.
Prejudice is in the eye of the beholder. The defendant is not getting along with his counsel. What bothers me so far in this case is that the trial judge observed the problem with this defendant than anyone that was appointed counsel for him. Shouldn't that have necessitated the trial court to get to the bottom of what the problem was and try and fix it more effectively than just saying, well, we'll give you a new counsel, and then new counsel
came up short, and he said, well, you've had one new counsel, that's it. It seems to me that there was a problem with this defendant and any counsel that may have been appointed. And don't you think the trial court should have tried to get to the bottom of that and fix that problem before the trial started?
The only evidence I recall, the transcript of the last communication into the jail, where counsel expressed
to the jail office that he didn't want to be concerned. But there is no hearing there. There is no questioning of the defendant by the judge as to what is the problem now, Mr. So-and-so? Why can't you get along with your attorney? Tell me what these problems are, and we'll see if they really are a problem. He never did that, did he? And the first time? I mean, the second time.
Well, I'm sure you get pretty angry. Not when
Would you say that it's most people would argue that, especially in the face of a pretty strong, the crime was vicious, all the things that you would expect a jury to give a death sentence, a death recommendation, all those things are here. And when a defendant says, "Well, I'm not going to give any part that might help me here," why, the defender argues that seems like such a poor choice that why wouldn't we inquire as to whether or not this person is competent?
There wasn't a counsel argument that the counsel did inquire to the reasons for waiting and made sure that the defendant understood what the really was competent to get.
Mm-hmm.
Videotape very interesting. How do you take a bloodhound and trace from the scene of the crime to the defendant's house, and then a week later, or over a period of time later, you come and try to reconstruct that, particularly when the bloodhound, as I recall it, had to be re-scented. You thought that was a little fishy, too. Two means I think it's fishy. I didn't say it was fishy. I just have been inquiring about it, counsel. All right, it's a little fishy. Tell me about it. Well, it's not a common practice to re-tape it after the event, is it? They taped the path.
Yeah, the path, yeah.
And the dog really had varied from that path, mm-hmm. hadn't it?
They didn't focus on the path.
They didn't know because they didn't do it at the time the dog was there. They did it later, as I recall it.
They didn't do that at the time the dog was there.
That's right. Testified, was there any testimony from which the jury could have construed that he was on parole for a prior murder?
Where
my question, was there any indication why he was on parole? Because he was on parole for a prior murder.
No.
Okay, that didn't happen until the mitigation stage. Because they tried the specs separately. And the reason you had to have the parole officer testify that he was on parole was to justify the search.
We're explaining the search of the place that was the family.
to justify the search. Because, as a matter of fact, the monument or the, what did we,
figurine.
The figurine, she thought that wasn't the right figurine. She thought it was larger, didn't she? So with the officers that came in using her saying, that's important, don't touch it. I know that. But when they went in, she didn't recognize the importance of that figurine. And in fact, it was the deputies that did, didn't they? Because didn't they tell her not to touch it? Okay.
What's your strongest argument on it? This is a, I think it's some of the closest case, and the phone didn't discuss it in oral argument, which means technically she shouldn't bring it up in rebuttal, but if I'm going to give her a chance to by asking the question because I'm curious about it, is what's your strongest argument on that point, that the parole officer goes into the house without a warrant, and it looks, it has this, it could be pretextual, and so what's your strongest argument on that issue?
Well, the strongest argument on that is what happened is that she initiated the decision to conduct the search for a woman. And it wasn't, not only did the police actually refuse to go for her, she asked the police to go for her, they refused because they didn't have a warrant.
I thought he offered that after to protect her, I guess, was the decision that she made, walk into some harm.
Well, but there, by the request, I'm not sure what they expected. I think that they might have previously visited the house right before that, and a few accounts told them that the defendant was not there, whether they accepted that or not, I don't know. But the information they have is that they were not there. So before you make any of the final facts, not legal, so please come and
prior to the time they were dismissed.
Additionally, the record does not state that the attorney said there was no discussion of the plea bargain. They indicated that they were not trying to pressure him to plea bargain, but did acknowledge that 3.5 weeks prior to the arraignment, which I will note, cut that investigation time in half, that he did discuss a plea agreement with Mr. Downs, and that's when that relationship begins to break down.
With any lawyer? Or should we not ask that question?
And it seems to me he didn't like what he could hear. And here's the messenger. He didn't want to talk to the messenger. He changed the messenger. What's the likelihood he's going to talk to the next person about that evidence that he knows is going to hurt him?
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.